Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello, and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. And I'm delighted to be talking to the distinguished Australian film director, Bruce Beresford, twice nominated for an Oscar and director of the Oscar-winning Driving Miss Daisy. And also a distinguished contributor to the Oldie magazine. And Bruce, you've written brilliantly after directing over 30 films about what it's like to make a film. You wrote a piece for us not long ago saying, contrary to the cliche that actors are terrible, the tricky people are the producers and the production executives. Is that right?
That has been my experience, yes. You see, actors are... they're really dependent on the director. And... they really do their best to satisfy the director. You still get an odd one. I think of it, I've done 34 films. If I had to name three actors I thought were very difficult to work with, it'd be tricky.
That's amazing.
But on the other hand, if I had to list mad producers and executives, I could do it quite easily.
And you do. You describe making your brilliant film, Driving Miss Daisy, Oscar-winning, came out in 1989, and they refused initially to film driving scenes, which seems strange in a film called Driving Miss Daisy.
Yes, that was because they just said they're not necessary. You've got these scenes that they're talking in the car. And I said, but we never see the car. I said, we only see the interior. We need to see the car going through streets, towns, countryside. And they said, no, we're not paying for that. And finally, after a lot of argument, I got the producer, Richard Zanuck, who was a wonderful man. He actually said, look, we can afford to have you shoot for just a couple of days, but it's only you and the cameraman and a couple of doubles in the car. So off we went.
And you could produce feature film level films with just that amount of people, can you? Just
we had, and yeah. We had to do it, Harry. Yeah. Yes, the cameraman, Peter James, is... I've now shot 14 films with him altogether. He's a brilliant cameraman. And I was the assistant. I had to get out and erect road signs and put a sign up saying Nevada or whatever state it was that they were meant to be in.
And give it the impression that it was in the 1950s as well.
Yes, yeah. It was all period. So that was another problem. We couldn't photograph other cars because they'd all have been wrong. But we only filmed for 2 days. I think we got about 7 or 8 shots, they're all in the film.
Which presumably that's a very high hit rate, isn't it?
Yes, the whole lot. Every single shot was in the film.
And so these production executives, they make crazy demands. I think you also said in Driving Miss Daisy, they remove a crucial scene in a black church where Miss Daisy goes to the funeral ceremony for her maid. And they tried to remove the famous opera aria, Song to the Moon, though it's crucial that she goes to the opera.
They wanted to remove those. Nothing was removed, largely because I dug my heels in, and so did Richard Zanuck, the producer. I mean, he just said, he was very short with them. He used to just get on the phone and say, we're not doing that, and he'd bang the phone down. So there was no discussion.
And it seems there's an awful lot of happenstance and chance. So that terrific film... it was helped because Warner's reluctantly released the film when they suddenly needed a Christmas release. Is that right?
Yes, we had a big stroke of luck with Driving Miss Daisy because Warner's... I don't know who saw it. I think some minor executives. They were going to put it on just in an art house in San Francisco. Then they realised at the last minute that their big Christmas film, which was called In Country, was released with a lot of publicity. It just tanked. People didn't like it. People didn't go. And they said, oh, what are we going to do? We haven't got a Christmas film. So they had a look at a lot of films where they had a minor interest, maybe distribution, or they put in a little bit of money. And Driving Miss Daisy was one of those. And then they said to me, this is it. We're going to push this one. Next thing I know, it opens not in the art house in San Francisco, in 2,000 or more cinemas.
Amazing. And you talked about your brilliant film, Breaker Morant, Oscar-nominated, that they wanted to delete or partially delete the final scene because of a hand-holding incident.
That's right. Well, you see, I don't know if you know the film. These Australians were executed. Were executed in Pretoria on the veldt during the Boer War. They were executed for shooting prisoners, and there were two Australians. And as they walked towards the chairs, they were shot on chairs. As they walked towards the chairs, they held hands. They really did this because I found this mentioned in a letter by a member of the firing squad, which was in the Imperial War Museum here. And I thought, that's wonderful. I mean, that's wonderful that they did that. And then when the producers saw it in South Australia, they said, oh, everyone will think that they're lovers, homosexuals. Yeah. And I said, there is no possibility of that. None. And it's perfectly obvious that this is not the, can't possibly be the case. They brought out David Putnam from England to have a look at the film, and they said, whatever he decides, that's what we do.
He was the producer, was he?
No, he was just, he had some sort of executive position with the film corporation, but they said, let him decide. So they showed the film to him. He came to Adelaide. He saw the film and he said, leave it in.
And no one ever objected, of course.
No, of course not. I mean, it was, you know, it was such a wonderful moment.
So they're just very capricious, aren't they? You talk about in your film Paradise Road, they wanted to get rid of any scene with Cate Blanchett in it, which, she's done rather well since.
We actually had to do that, yes. They actually said, you've got to send us a cut of the film without Cate Blanchett. And I said, well, she has the leading role. And they said, we want to see it without her ever appearing. And I said, but she's she's wonderful. I mean, what's the problem? They said, send it. So anyway, I thought, we'll send it. So we did send it. The film only ran about 45 minutes.
Having been 2 hours.
Yeah, two hours. Yes.
And just some random executive didn't like the look of her. Is that what it was?
They never liked Cate Blanchett. I know when they put out the first DVD box, her name wasn't on it, although she has, in fact, the leading role.
How amazing.
I thought, how can they be so hostile to a young actress who's so extraordinarily talented? I mean, she's now won the Academy Award twice. I've never understood it.
And kind of contrary-wise, you wrote another brilliant piece about why films have got much longer. And I've noticed this over the last 20 years, getting lots of films around the three-hour mark. Why is, when they used to be kind of around 2 hours, why has that happened?
Well, there's three or four reasons. I think I outlined them in that article, and so I don't want to go on boringly about it. I think a key factor was the rise of the director due to the French film critics. A lot of the leading French critics who were very articulate idolised certain directors and said they can do no wrong. And then nobody wanted to touch their films. So they'd say, oh, we'll make it longer, make it longer, make it longer. And they'd get up 2 hours, 2.5 hours, 3 hours. Nobody dared touch them. And there's been a string of directors who were virtually canonised.
Like Martin Scorsese with his last film. I think that's three and a half hours, I think.
Yes, I thought that was... I mean, he is a great director, one of the greatest that ever lived. Yeah, yeah. But that film is terribly boring at that length.
And do you think... Because you wrote in that piece that you are happy as a director to be criticised. It's a useful process. And to be told, we've got to cut this film, make it shorter.
Well, yes, I mean, as a director, what I'd like to do is, if people think that some scene should be shorter or some characterisation should have some other stress on it, I'm always willing to listen, because you never know. You might miss something and they suddenly say something, you think, that's right. That was what was wrong with that scene. He hit the nail on the head, or she hit the nail on the head. Yes, I'm willing to listen.
And a second pair of eyes, even if they're not as good as your own, can often be very refreshing, as if it's a bit like editing stuff.
Well, I think probably the greatest advantage a director can have is that when you show it to a group of the completely uninitiated, so you show it to a test audience who know nothing whatever about the film, don't know the story, and don't know anyone who worked on the film. then you get reactions which are completely genuine, and I really listen very closely to those.
And those are pretty effective, and they are a good reflection of what will happen.
Oh, very. I mean, what I do is at those screenings, I stand at the back of the theatre, and then you can sense the atmosphere, and suddenly you'll see people moving a bit, and I think it's a bit boring. I'm repeating information. I'll tighten that bit up. Or there'll be an unwanted laugh at something, and I'll think, that's right, it's a bit off key there. I'm going to make a change to that. That's the most advantageous thing to do.
Because presumably it must be really difficult. I mean, a film is a huge... involves a huge amount of people. While you're filming it, it's almost impossible to tell how good the final product will be.
It is, but I find... I can do is say the way I react as a director. When I'm directing a film, what's happening in front of the camera to me becomes very real, and I become involved in it. And I know assistants are always telling me I forget to say cut, because I'm living that life that's on the other side of the camera. And the actors look at me rather wonderingly, thinking, why isn't he stopping us? I think, oh, yes, we've got that bit.
And so you can tell, you can go, oh, my God, that's a good scene. You can see how it's going to come out.
I think I can, yes. Yeah. I think that, yes, I become totally involved in the atmosphere, mood of the film. And I do that when I go to the cinema and watch other people's films. I mean, I often get up and walk out, but a lot of times I don't. And I get very, very involved in the story. It's a great art form. I think I do the same with theatre and opera.
Yeah, we all do. Even me, not a director, you think this could be half an hour shorter or that shouldn't be in. And going back to the length of films, they did used to be incredibly ruthless. You talk about Orson Welles' experience on The Magnificent Ambersons.
Yes, producers in those days, before the rise of the French critics, producers, certain ones wouldn't hesitate to just go in and change it. I mean, I remember mentioning that in the My Darling Clementine, which is probably the best Western ever made, the producer, Daryl Zanuck, sent in another director to alter a few scenes. And
effectively so?
Yes, sometimes, occasionally effectively so. But there is a DVD available in which you have two films. You have My Darling Clementine by John Ford, and you have the one recut by Zanuck.
Right.
The Ford one is better.
Oh, really?
But in a couple of scenes, Zanuck was right.
And you refer to this process of the film's getting longer and the director's having more power, reaching its low with Heaven's Gate in, I think, 1980, and that became too long, and famously the greatest bankruptcy.
I thought that film was really terrible. Yes, I couldn't. I tried a couple of times to sit through it. I didn't succeed.
And Bruce, you've just finished work on a film called The Travellers, is that right? If you can tell us a bit about that.
Yes, that was a film that I wrote during the COVID lockdown. In Australia, everything went wrong. I had some films in America, I couldn't go. Nothing was going on. We were sort of locked in our houses. If you went out, if you walked a few kilometres, you'd be arrested. And anyway, so I thought I'd better write some scripts. So I think during that lockdown period, I wrote four or five film scripts. And one of them was The Travellers. I thought I'd like to make a story set in contemporary Australia. Having done a few, the last film I did was set in Australia in 1958. So I thought I'd make one set in contemporary Australia. And I did, about an Australian opera designer who comes back to his country town where he grew up because his mother is dying. And then it's what happens to him when he's there. And it's not, that sounds like a really heavy drama, but I hope it has, a light touch.
And it's finished, is that right?
Yes, it's all finished.
And will be released, yet to have a release date.
Yes, well, we're waiting, Sony, the distributors, and I'm waiting to hear what they're planning to do with it. I don't know. There are film distributors are another mystery. You never know what they're going to do. It's like driving Miss Daisy. We're going to put it on in an art house in San Francisco. No, we won't do that. We'll open it in 2,500 cinemas.
And there's a handful of people making that decision. Is that right?
There's often one.
Amazing. Amazing. You won't know who it is?
No, you often not. In right. the Daisy case, I did know.
Yeah.
Because I went to, I saw the man who was looking at all the films they had a little interest in. And I went with him, we ran it in a huge theatre. And I said, where is everybody? He said, there's just me. I said, but you've got to make this decision. He said, yeah, I might make this decision. But he only saw about 20 minutes of Driving Miss Daisy. Then he got up and walked out. And he said to me, that's it, we'll open this one. And no, first he said, is it as good, is the last three quarters of an hour as good as the beginning? I said, yes, it gets better and better. He said, good.
How amazing. tell me, Bruce, the story of Don's Party, one of my favourite films. Absolutely fantastic, incredibly funny. Was that a huge hit in Australia? Was it a big hit here as well?
No, it did very well in Australia. It didn't do very well anywhere else. I mean, it was a hard film to promote. It was at the start of all the Australian sort of filmmaking thing, and it had a bunch of actors in it that no one had ever heard of. It got fairly good reviews in England, as I remember. It didn't do very well.
Because is it not the case, this must be very frustrating, that it really is a fantastically funny, brilliant film, but that talent doesn't necessarily have its own reward, that if you direct a fantastic film, that doesn't necessarily end up being reflected in worldwide success?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I see films all the time. I go to a lot of films. I see films all the time that I'm sit there awestruck at the skill of the directors and the actors, and you think, this is just wonderful. And then films sort of come and go, no one pays much attention. I mean, it happens a lot.
It's fate. And we must talk about the late, great Barry Humphreys, a wonderful columnist for The Oldie. And you were one of his best friends. Perhaps you were his best friend. You first knew him in 1963.
Yes, I did. I met him when I first came to London in 1963. That's it. I was given his address by Patrick White, who said to me, oh, I'm a friend of Barry's, you should call him. He said, you two would get on well. I said, but I don't know. I would hesitate to do that. But after a few weeks in London, I thought, oh, I will call him. And then Barry said straight away, we must come over. We'll have a drink. You know. So we were, he's a very friendly. We had a lot in common. We liked a lot of the same music and art, and there was always a lot to talk about. And he was over all those years. That's about 50 years. He was a wonderful friend. He was extraordinarily good-natured. Well, I mean, you knew him too. I mean,
yes, well, the people would think of him as stupidly as being like Sir Les or Dame Edna. He was extremely polite, even to the work experience boy in the office.
To everybody.
Yeah.
He loved meeting people. I mean, we'd be on a film crew and he'd know everybody's name and their background. And I remember when we were in Tasmania once, we went there to write the second Barry McKenzie film script. And we were walking down the street and we bumped into this woman with a family. And he greeted her by name and the children and said, how are they going and all that. And I said, oh, who was that? Who is that woman, Barry? Oh, he said, she was in the audience when I did a show here a year or so ago. And he said, I met her. And he remembered not only her, but her children's names.
Amazing. And you said in your very moving piece about him in The Oldie, the Lesettes, Sir Les's sidekicks, came and visited him in hospital.
The Lesettes turned up together. Three or four of them came to really his deathbed. And they were there. It was very, very... And of course, he remembered all of their names.
And it's an overused word, but he was a genius, wasn't he? We've just had the sale of his incredible collection of pictures and books.
Yes, he had the most wonderful taste, I thought, in art. His art collection was the best I've ever seen. It was so beautiful. He had such an eye. And he had such a memory. You know, he'd read books and poems and he'd quote them at me. And, you know, I thought, how can you remember all that? I can never do that.
And he, Nick Garland, who did the pictures for the fantastic Barry McKenzie cartoon strip, which he made two terrific films, adored Barry, but he said he was at his happiest when he had people slightly ill at ease on the moment of being a bit angry. Did he do that with you? Did he tease you? Or it wasn't like that as a friend?
I don't know that he did. No. I mean, I used him. I think I directed him in three or four films altogether. One of them was completely negligible. But we made a drama, The Getting of Wisdom, where he played the headmaster of a girls' school. Completely straight performance. And he was wonderful. No, he was always very easy to work with, because directing it, he was one of those actors where I'd say, maybe we could try this, or if you thought of that, do this. He said, oh, I'll try that and we'll see how it works. Always cooperative.
Yes. And I talked to him on the phone about his column, and actually not long before he died, but his mind was moving so fast that sometimes he'd make a joke and I wouldn't get it. About a couple of seconds later, you get it, and then you want him to know that you've got it. Oh, no, and I get it. But his mind was moving at a million miles an hour, wasn't it?
It was. He moved very fast. He was always good company. People used to say to me, what's he really like? I said, he's really every bit as nice as he appears to be.
Yeah. And did he talk about this shameful episode where the Melbourne Comedy Festival cancelled him? Did that, not long before he died, did that distress him?
Very much. He was terribly upset. He was very proud that the Comedy Festival was named after him. And then, why did they change it? There was something they found. They thought he was sort of...
He was talking about women, which actually the latest court case in Britain has confirmed what he said.
I mean, it was ridiculous. And yes, he was very upset at that. And of course, he was sick in hospital at the time. And it was a terrible blow to him.
Because when you knew him in 63, you wrote about him still being very drunk then, but he could still, I think you saw him in Treasure Island, still completely perfect. Was the drunkenness very palpable when he was drunk? Or
he
still brilliant?
It used to amaze me that he could go on stage and do these wonderful performances, having drunk a hell of a lot of stuff beforehand. But it was getting out of hand. By the time AA got hold of him, he was in pretty bad shape. He was drinking a hell of a lot. I remember he used to come to my place when I lived in Brixton, and he'd be hammering on the door before, it was 7:30 in the morning, saying, can I get a drink? There's a pub in the corner there. Are they open? I said, Barry, they're not open. It's not a good idea. And it was going terribly wrong. Then luckily, the AA people got him and pinned his shoulders to the floor. And after 1973, never drank again.
Amazing. And you wrote too about not just the brilliance of Sir Les Paterson as a performer, but I agree with you. His book, Sir Les's book, The Traveller's Tool, is one of the greatest books of all time. Your favourite chapter is My Tool in Your Hand. He was supreme, wasn't he? I think Sir Les, utter genius, but the perfect level of vulgarity and obscenity is terrific.
It was. He based that character, I think I might have told you, on an Australian who was in the embassy here that we had lunch with after filming the Barry McKenzie film. And Barry would look at this man curiously, and I said later, Barry, why did you keep... You were so fascinated by the Australian consul or the assistant consul, whatever he was. And Barry said, I just thought he was interesting. And then Les Paterson appeared, and he looked and sounded just like that man.
And he was grotesque, was he? Stains down the shirt front.
Yes, it was incredible.
And... tell me, Bruce, what do you think it is about that generation? You're quite a bit younger than Barry, but if you don't mind me grouping you with Barry, Jermaine Greer, Clive James, coming over here, being absolutely brilliant. I asked the late Carmen Khalil this, and she put it down to the extremely good educational system in Australia, so just being extremely well-educated, and then throw in Australia into the mix. Would you say there was something that you share... Robert Hughes, there's a long list.
Yes,
with that generation.
I mean, The group you mentioned all knew each other. I don't know. I mean, most were friends. I don't really understand how that. I think it's a sort of coincidence. I mean, look what happened in France with all those painters that came in the 19th century. They, a lot of them, they knew each other. And you think, why? Why don't they do it now? I don't really understand. I mean, the education system in Australia, yes, it was pretty good. I don't know.
No.
I think it's just one of those flukes.
Right. And I hope it's still there, that combination in Australia of extreme education, but fantastic outspokenness. When I said to Carmen Khalil, when the late Queen was still alive, I said, "You're a Republican, aren't you?" And she said, "Yes, I am, but I don't want to cut the Queen's tits off." I thought that was fantastic. I hope that's still there in Australia. I hope political correctness, or whatever you want to call it, hasn't got rid of that strain.
There is a rather attractive directness out there about people. And I worked in my new film. I worked in West Australia with a West Australian crew that I'd never worked with before. And I thought, I wonder what they're like. They were just so, it was so easy to blend in with them because they were really like the New South Wales crew. They were just so, they just said exactly what they were thinking all the time.
Right.
And the fact that I was a director, they didn't sort of hedge their bets. They just say, "Look, Bruce, we should do this, we should do that. What do you think about this? What do you think?" It was refreshing.
Right. Bruce, when you came over here in the early 60s, what was bringing you over here? Barry talked about it, still thinking of Britain as the mother country. It was the thing you did. Was that the same with you?
Yes, it was. It was. I'd always wanted to travel. From when I was a student. In fact, I was on the boat to England on the day of my final university exam. And I thought, well, I hope I get that degree because I'll be a bit sunk if I don't. And I just left straight away. I wanted to see London and Paris and travel around Europe. And I'm thrilled that I did. And I made a lot of friends here pretty well straight away. You know, I was working in odd jobs. I mean, gosh, one point I was working with a bunch of Irishmen dismantling a factory, and I was teaching in a girls' school, and I was trying all the time to get into the film business.
But you did want to become a film director.
I did. That was my aim. I'd made some short films in Australia because it was more difficult here than I'd ever imagined, because in those days the unions were lethal. But eventually I got a job at the British Film Institute, and I was there for a bit over five years.
And the Barry McKenzie films, which you made with Barry Humphries, were they difficult to make, or had it been such a hit, the cartoon strip, it was greenlit quite easily?
No, the Barry McKenzie films, they were fun to make, and we made them. They were very low budgets, but for a director, they were disastrous. Because, you see, although they were terribly popular in Australia, the reviews were appallingly hostile. And then, I sort of painted myself into a corner as a sort of uncouth larrikin, and I couldn't get any work at all. It was because I was just a lout. I applied to join the Directors Guild in Australia, and I was turned down. They said, "No, we don't want people like you. You know, we want to make cultured sort of films." You know, the fact that I made popular successes was not seen as a plus.
Never be forgiven. And this was ignorant reviewers who hadn't got the point of the cartoon strip, and therefore the film, you think?
I thought they were irrationally hostile to the film, because it was Barry and I were both very taken aback, because we just thought, these are really good fun. I mean, it wasn't that they were loaded down with outlandish sex scenes or nudity. In fact, Barry McKenzie as a character was a terrible prude.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't want anything like that.
Edward Bruce, well, that's a very good place to stop. And thank you so much to Bruce Beresford for appearing on Radio Oldie. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.